and kept two for scouting around. Finally, one evening when the scholar at the Punti store assured her that the time was auspicious, she washed her muddy feet, brushed her one blue uniform, tied a widow's cloth about her sparsely haired head, and topped it with her wicker hat. Brushing her cheeks with her hands so that she might look as presentable as possible, she left home without speaking to anyone, and walked resolutely down Nu'uanu, where she purchased a bag of brown, chewy candies covered with poppy seed. Clutching the candy in her hand, she entered busy Hotel Street in the heart of Chinatown and turned right, walking past Asia's restaurant and Europe's vegetable stand, while she looked for a narrow alley that cut back among a maze of Chinese shacks. At last she found it, and with a prayer to Kuan Yin for mercy on her mission, she ducked beneath the bamboo poles that suspended drying laundry completely across the alley. Finally, she reached a kitchen door which belonged to a house somewhat more pretentious than the rest, yet one of which few Haoleis could have known the existence, for it was well hidden by hovels. This was the home of Qing, Honolulu's wealthiest haka, and it was presumptuous of Nyok Tsin to be calling there. She knocked and waited obediently until the tall, well-fed mistress of the house appeared and looked out in the darkness to identify her impecunious visitor. The taller woman did not speak, and Nyok Tsin said deferentially, "May a thousand benedictions fall upon you on this auspicious night, my dear mother-in-law." The phrase was an honorary one and implied no relationship, so the wealthy woman accepted it imperiously and said, "Come in, my dear sister-in-law. Have you had your meal?" This again was a formality, so Nyok Tsin replied, as custom required, "I have eaten, but how about you?" She was impressed by the munificence of the kitchen and its close attention to detail. The two windows were sufficiently high so that the Qing money could not leak out. The doors were not in a straight line, which kept the dragon of happiness from escaping, and the land leading up to the doors did not slope away from the house so that good fortune did not drift away. The kitchen had a brick stove on which a permanent teapot rested, and now the Qing woman poured Nyok Tsin a cup of the stale stuff. Not too big a cup, which would have accorded Nyok Tsin an esteem she did not merit, nor too small, which would have brought reflections of niggardliness upon the Qings. "Be seated, my dear sister-in-law," the wealthy woman said. In her outward appearance, nothing betrayed the fact that she controlled a good deal of money. She wore no jewelry, no paint, no combs in her hair. Her simple dress was the same as Nyok Tsin's, and she also was barefooted. But to her visitor's calculating eye, Mrs. Qing was obviously a person of wealth. Her kitchen was crowded with food. Three hams hung from bamboo poles, and five glistening dried ducks, their bills hanging downward with drops of redolent oil gathering at the tips. There were bunches of white cabbage, baskets of vegetables, and bags of nuts. Throughout the kitchen, there was the grand confusion loved by people who have money, and Mrs. Qing grandly swept aside some of the clutter that hid her table, making a small space on which Nyok Tsin placed her bag of candies. Neither woman spoke of the bag, but each was painfully aware of its presence, and as the conversation developed, they stared at the candies with positive fascination. "Why do you come to my poor house on such an auspicious night, my dear sister-in-law?" the older woman asked with studied sweetness. Nyok Tsin sat with her stubborn, hard-working hands folded in her lap and her brown feet flat on the floor. Bluntly she said, "Since I am not as wealthy as my honored mother-in-law, I cannot afford to hire a go-between. So I have been shameful and have broken the rules of decent behavior. I have come to ask for your daughter, Siu Kim." Mrs. Qing showed no surprise, but unconsciously she drew back and took her hands far from the candies. Nyok Tsin detected this and was hurt, but she continued to smile frankly at her hostess. Finally, after an awkward moment, Mrs. Ching said in a silken voice, "I thought your son Ah Chao already had a wife." "He does, my dear mother-in-law," Yuk-tsin replied evenly, launching her first barb of the evening. "I arranged a very fine marriage for him with the Lam girl." Mrs. Ching said, "Apunti, I believe." Yuk-tsin dropped her eyes modestly and confessed, "Apunti, yes. But she brought a good deal of gold with her, and now my son owns his restaurant."
"He owns the building?" Mrs. Ching inquired in surprise.
"Completely," Yuk-tsin said with firmness. "But of course our family controls it."
"It was my understanding that your second son was intending to marry a Hawaiian."
"He is," Yuk-tsin confessed. She waited so that Mrs. Ching could react with distaste, then added quietly, "I was able to find him a Hawaiian girl with several large pieces of land."
"Indeed. And does the land now belong to your family?"
"It does."
"Hmm,"
Mrs. Ching mused. She leaned forward ever so slightly, and the talk resumed. She said, "I observe that your youngest son plays mainly with Hawaiians. I suppose that one day he will marry one."
"There are many Hawaiian girls who seem to like my son, and fortunately they all have large landholdings," Yuk-tsin said.
Then, to establish herself on an equal footing with Mrs. Ching, she added boldly, "Since my family will not return to China, I think it best that the boys find wives here."
"So that you were even willing to allow your oldest son to marry Apunti?"
Yuk-tsin was not going to be stampeded by this woman. With a good deal of self-possession, she said, "I want my family to live in the new style, not as in the high village that you and I knew as girls."
Mrs. Ching sensed a rebuke in these words and said bluntly, "What you mean is that you are building a family into which a decent Hakka girl, like my daughter Siu Kim, would hardly want to marry, and into which I would not permit her to marry." This was an important speech, for although it was harsh, Yuk-tsin did not know whether Mrs. Ching was formally ending negotiations or whether she was trying legitimately to undermine Yuk-tsin's bargaining position, so that when final discussions of money came up, the girl's side could drive a harder bargain. At any rate, Yuk-tsin felt that the time had come for her to detonate her first bomb, so she dropped it gently, letting it explode among the hams and glistening rye ducks.
"I realize, my dearest mother-in-law, that a wealthy woman like you would have objections to marrying a fine girl like Siu Kim into a poor family like ours. But there is one thing you have overlooked. Yesterday, the scholar at the Punti store cast my son Africa's horoscope." And she placed on the crowded table, beside the bag of candy, a slip of paper. And when it was done, the scholar gasped for sheer pleasure, for he said, "I have never seen a finer horoscope for a young man in my entire life." That's what he said. The two women, neither of whom could read, studied the precious slip of paper, and Mrs. Ching asked cautiously, "Are you sure this is your son's?"
"It is."
"And it speaks well?" Modestly, Yuk-tsin looked down at her feet. In a soft voice, she said, "Money, knowledge, a position even better than a scholar in China, a long, prosperous life with many children, those were the words for my son." The two women sat in silence, for each knew what a rare thing was before them. They stared at the premonitory paper, and slowly Mrs. Ching rose. "My dear sister-in-law, I think I had better make some more tea." With bounding joy, Yuk-tsin heard these words, for they erased any that had been said earlier. But modestly, she kept her eyes down and did not watch Mrs. Ching as she brewed fresh tea, not the old stuff waiting on the back of the stove, and poured it into a fine china cup. This was, up to then, the moment of greatest triumph in Yuk-tsin's life,
and she tasted the fine, fresh tea.
"Sue Kim," Mrs. Ching began on a fresh tack, "is an unusual girl, and she has been asked for by more than a dozen men, some of them with considerable wealth."
Yuk-tsin sipped her tea and courteously allowed Mrs. Ching to run up the bargaining price for her daughter. Over the edge of her cup, the ruder-mannered younger woman studied the bag of candies and thought, "I will let her talk about her daughter for 5 minutes, and then I'll explode my next cannon."
When Mrs. Ching finished explaining why, in common decency, she had to save Sue Kim for a wealthier man than Africa Key was apt to be, Yuk-tsin said bluntly,
"It is not every day that an average Hakka girl like Sue Kim has a chance to marry a man who is going to graduate from a fine college in America and become a lawyer. I should think, as her mother, that you would jump at this opportunity and throw in a good dowry as well."
Mrs. Ching was stunned by this news, but she was no mean negotiator. She did not raise an eyebrow, but asked in a silky voice, "How can a vegetable woman possibly send her son to America?"
Meticulously, Yuk-tsin counted off. "We own the land up Nu'uanu. We own the land in the forest. We own very fine fields in Manoa. Asia owns his restaurant, and Europe has paid large sums toward the building where his vegetable store is. Each of my sons works, as do I, and I am sure that right now we have enough money to send Africa to Michigan."
Mrs. Ching was visibly jolted by this narration, and she now wheeled into position her heaviest ammunition.
"Your son's prospects sound, well, interesting. But of course his father was a leper."
Yuk-tsin did not flinch.
"The main reason why I was able to make such a favorable marriage with the Hawaiian girl, who brought us so much land, was that the Hawaiians know me as the Pake Kukua, and they have said that if Africa does become a lawyer, they will send all their business to the son of the Pake Kukua."
The two tough-minded Hakka women glared at each other in mutual respect, and as they did so, Mrs. Ching made her decision. Imperceptibly, she allowed her right hand to steal across the table. She extended two fingers and slowly encircled the bag of brown candy dusted with poppy seeds. Noiselessly, she pulled it toward her, and Yuk-tsin, witnessing these climactic gestures, thought, "I must not cry." And she fought back her tears, lest they spill out of her sloping eyes and betray to the Ching woman her great joy. With this acceptance of the candy, the marriage was agreed upon. Up to this time, Yuk-tsin had not yet seen Sue Kim. And of course, Africa Key was not even aware that his auntie was planning his marriage. Neither he nor Sue Kim was told anything, especially since the basic financial negotiations were to consume the better part of a year. But one day Yuk-tsin saw the attractive girl for whom she had been bargaining, and she admitted to Mrs. Ching, "Your daughter, Beautiful Gold, is even more desirable than you told me." But as she said these words, she happened to look past Sue Kim, who was then 13, and in the doorway behind, wearing a blue and gold Chinese dress, stood Sue Kim's 11-year-old sister, Sue Han, and Yuk-tsin sucked in her breath with pleasure.
"What is that one's name?" she asked. And Mrs. Ching replied simply, "Sue Han, beautiful girl, but she will be saved for a very wealthy man."
Yuk-tsin smiled at the little girl and remembered her name. These were exciting years in the Key House. The original grass shack had been replaced by one of the ugliest buildings in Honolulu, an unadorned two-story bleak wooden house to which had been appended as afterthoughts a collection of lean-to sheds. A mango tree and a coconut palm gave some shade, but there was no lawn nor any flowers. Pigs were kept in the yard and chickens in the kitchen.
But the dominant occupants were enormous Kimo, who did all the cooking for the family, and sprawling Apikela, who did the washing and made the poi. There was a running battle between Nyuk-tsin on the one hand and everyone else on the other. She liked rice and Chinese food. They insisted upon poi and American-style food. When, at the end of a long day's work, she begged for rice, Big Kimo at the stove shrugged his shoulders, and the boys yelled, "Oh, Auntie, who wants rice?" If she did, she had to cook it herself, because Kimo refused to bother. Her two married sons lived with her, of course, one family to a room, and Apikela took care of the babies that began to arrive regularly. What with the pigs and the chickens and the babies, it was a noisy, happy island home. There were many like it, for Chinese and Hawaiians lived together easily. At the pool room one day, Kimo came upon a new importation from Portugal, a ukulele, and like a boy he badgered Nyuk-tsin until she bought him one. Then Apikela demanded one, and Europe's wife, and songs from the Chinese house filled the valley. In the middle of 1886, when Africa Key was 18, it was announced that early next year he would marry the wealthy Hakka girl, Ching Siu Kim. He started looking about the city to see who she was, and one day he saw her walking in Aala Park, but he could not be sure that she was the girl picked out for him, and he thought, it would be pleasant if she were a girl like that one. The wedding was an impressive affair with many guests, for the Chings were important. And before Africa Key finally climbed aboard the ship to go to Michigan, he was already the father of three children. Dutifully, he took the family genealogical book and the poem to the scholar in the Punti store, and there the man gave his sons their names. The poem showed that the name of this fourth generation must be Kun, Earth, and accordingly the two boys' names were Kun Chuk, the center of the earth, and Kun Yuen, the essence of the earth, which produces all. But their parents called them simply Sam and Harvey. The Chinese names were duly forwarded to the Low Village, so that when 21-year-old Africa finally enrolled at Michigan, he was not only head of a burgeoning family left behind in Honolulu, but also the member of a powerful clan whose existence had continued in the Low Village for thousands of years. But the memory which recurred most often to Africa as he studied law in Michigan concerned an event which took place on his last morning in Honolulu. Nyuk-tsin assembled her five sons and led them to the letter writer at the Punti store. There she delivered $50 that the family in Honolulu desperately needed for its various ventures. Asia and Europe gasped to see this amount of money being stolen from the Keys, and certainly Africa could have used it in Michigan. But Nyuk-tsin said, "Your mother in China may need this money. It may be a bad year for the crops. It is your duty above everything else to pay respect to your mother." If at Michigan Africa Key excelled at law, it was partly because he understood the fundamental fact that law directs the ongoing of society. It is rooted in the past, determines the present, and protects the future. Better than any other student in the law school, Africa appreciated these conservative principles. On the day he sailed to America on the H&H liner Molokai, Nyuk-tsin climbed aboard a little island steamer and made her first pilgrimage to her husband's grave at the leper settlement of Kalawao. For she too was imbued with this sense of continuity, and if her ablest son was that day setting forth for a new world, it was only because the dead gambler Ki Mun Kai had been good to her. This time, the island steamer did not swing around the peninsula and throw its passengers brutally ashore into the cold and unprotected hell of Kalawao. The vessel sailed directly to the pier at Kalupapa, on the kindly side of the peninsula, and discharged its cargo decently. Doctors and nurses were on hand to assist the new lepers, and the big white missionary home for lepers provided them a place to sleep. At the missionary hospital, they still found no medicine that combated the disease itself, but they found charitable care that protected them from pneumonia and tuberculosis, which had once been so prevalent. Nyuktsin walked through the clean new settlement and up past the volcano crater. Then she stopped, and an ache past understanding assailed her, for she looked down upon the most beautiful sight she had ever seen. It was more dramatic than the hills of China, lovelier than the valleys of Honolulu. In the distance rose the soaring cliffs of Molokai, with white spray beating upon their rock bases, and gossamer waterfalls leaping from their summits to fall 3,000 silvery feet. The ocean was blue, and the small islands that clustered offshore formed handsome patterns. The fields of Kalawao, now empty of lepers, were soft and green, as they had been 1,000 years before that horrible disease was known in the islands. 2 vacant churches, one Protestant and one Catholic, stood where once there had been terror. The house she had built with her own hands no longer had a roof. How sweet, she thought, were the days Munkai and Palani and I spent there. Oh, how I wish I could see those 2 good men once more. In her mind's eye she saw them not with noses and lips falling away and with stumps of hands, but as men. How I would like to see them once more playing fantan on the shore. That night she spent at Kalawao in the home of a kokua she had known years before, and on the next morning at cockcrow, in the 3rd hour, she left the house and went to her husband's grave, so that she would be there when his spirit rose to walk about the valley. In the moonlight she carefully replaced any rocks that had fallen away. She brushed the earth and pulled weeds. Carefully she erected a slab on which his name, Ki Munkai, had been printed in gold letters. Then she undid a bundle and ceremoniously placed a fine set of new dishes about the grave, putting into them the 3 required delicacies, roast pig, chicken, and fish. On saucers she placed oranges, boiled rice, little cakes with caraway, and brown candies with poppy seed. Then she lit a small candle, so that its incense would infuse the atmosphere and make it congenial to the ghost. And when these preparations were completed, she waited for the dawn. When her husband's ghost appeared, he found no tree to roost in, as he would have expected in China, where trees were plentiful, and where they were kept near graves for just that purpose. But he did find a perching place on the rocky cliffs that rose behind his grave, and there in the warm sunlight, away from the cold ocean breezes, he sat with his dutiful wife.